So the materials for today, though short, actually provide a good opportunity to review virtually everything. And so that's what we'll be doing. We're going to get only through habit. The sexual misconduct materials are for next class. So character and habit, civil cases, the Perrin case. It's a really great opportunity. Lauren Reynas?
Yes.
So what happened in this case?
So he was in a car accident and he became violent with the police officers.
Who he? So what is this case?
They hit the diminished streets of this parent estate, brought us to the court's claim for damages, and the officers claimed self-defense.
Okay, so it's a civil rights case. Do you know what that is? You familiar with it?
No. I should have looked it up.
Well, it's something that will recur. Comes up a lot in this course. Part of the civil rights legislation in the reform of things was the adoption of a statutory section that allows people who've been denied their civil rights to file a civil suit to recover damages. This is kind of important because it is the alternative to the exclusionary rule. And in fact, some of the justices, both sitting now and sitting in the past, would argue that the availability of a civil remedy is all that a person needs when their civil rights have been violated. So 42 U.S.C. section 1983 gives rise to a 1983 action, and that's what it's called, where a person whose civil rights have been trampled can sue for civil damages. Now here we have the person whose rights were denied is dead. So their survivors bring this lawsuit. So the defendants are who? And particularly the officer who shot him dead. So we've seen another case like this before, remember, and we'll see many more. So the plaintiff, the heir or survivor of the deceased, claimed that the police officers violated his civil rights by shooting and killing him. And defendant, claimed self-defense. What was the evidence that they brought in at the trial court level and was the subject of this appeal?
The police officers testified that there have been multiple violent encounters with Perrin in the past, and that he hated the police and always had that same violent reaction towards them.
Yeah, so what's wrong with this picture? It sounds like good way to put it. It smells like character evidence too. If it's offered as character evidence, what should have been the result at the trial court level? Well, defendants can introduce character evidence. Isn't this character evidence in this case within the exceptions that are provided in the federal rules under the mercy doctrine? I don't have my pamphlet because I gave it to someone. Yes. But I forgot to bring an extra one. Well, let's look at 404, which is the source of the character evidence rule in the federal rules. So what's the argument that this is admissible on behalf of the defendant police officers under Rule 404? Under 404A. Well, before you get to 405, you got to deal with 404. If you go directly to 405, you've made a big mistake. Because you have to identify whether the evidence of a character trait is admissible, and the answer to that lies in 404. Certainly in the first instance, 404A identifies those few exceptions that can apply to a defendant in a criminal case. And by the way, 404A2 now says the following exceptions apply in a criminal case. This was the language of the restyled rewrite of the rules. But all courts that have ever dealt with this previously have treated it as though it said criminal case alone, because it made no sense otherwise. So specifically, A2 what's the argument for the defendant in this case? Lauren? But what section would it apply to? Exceptions for a defendant or victim in a criminal case.
To be.
To be or not to be? Yes. Defendant may offer evidence of an alleged victim's pertinent trait. Isn't this a pertinent trait? Violence or aggressiveness as a character trait of the plaintiffs.
I guess you could argue that, but doesn't it also seem like it's prior similar instances of conduct?
Well, it may be that, but the first question is it a provable character trait? And clearly it is. It's a pertinent trait of character in a self-defense claim, particularly based on a first aggressor theory, which is what was involved in this case. But there's two problems with it. You've already alluded to one. You want to go to the back end. I want to go to the front end. It says, as a particular requirement of the application of this rule, exceptions apply in a criminal case. What's the problem with that? It's not a criminal case. This is a civil case. 1983 action is a civil case. And in fact, the notion that there is any exception for proof of character in a civil case other than relating to witnesses is anti the rules. It's never been held in other cases. And so this court is reaching out even to consider it. But the court held what with respect to the admissibility of character evidence in a civil case under this rule? What did this court hold? You're not going to find it in the rule.
Well, are you talking about like at the trial they allowed
it? At the trial, the court, trial court let it in. Now we're up on appeal.
They allowed it as well. As habit evidence.
Well, I'm talking character evidence. You keep wanting to change the subject because you know the answer ultimately. This court held something with respect to the character evidence rule, which you have to know about because you're reading the materials from this casebook, but I'm going to advise you to erase it from your memory. So what am I talking about? What did the appellate court hold with respect to the trial court's decision that this evidence was admissible as character evidence under 404A2? Because?
Because there are permitted testimony about specific violence.
No, you still want to go to the back end. We're dealing with still the front end. The evidence should not have been admitted because it's a criminal case, but the court said what with respect to that? A lot of people want to jump in here, so Angelica?
Isn't that the case was criminal in nature?
Yes, this is the analog of a criminal case, and if it had been brought as a criminal case, it would make a lot of sense because then the plaintiff would be the prosecution and the defendant would still be the defendant police officers. So this court held as a matter of precedential determination that the character evidence exception for a defendant's proof of victim's character is admissible in a civil case which involves a similar cause of action to a criminal case. But now we can get to where you want to go. Nonetheless, the court held what with respect ultimately to the admissibility of the proffered evidence?
That it was erroneous to admit testimony because it was about
a specific
violent incident.
Yes. Specific what?
It says here specific violent incidents involving character.
Yes, specific instances of conduct. And now, how do we know that that's a violation of the rules? What rule is involved? Yes, we get to where you wanted to start out with. So clearly, this is determined by 405. But wouldn't you argue for the defense that this is a specific instance of conduct to prove an essential element of the cause of action or defense? Would you argue that? And therefore it's admissible under 405 because evidence of the specific instances of violent behavior prove a character trait that is an essential element of the cause of action or defense. Here it's the defense of self-defense. Being the first aggressor, isn't that an element of self-defense? Would you argue that?
Yeah.
And would you win?
No.
Why not?
Because, no. But I can't articulate.
What?
I can't articulate that, because I don't know my basis for it.
Well, I grant you that this is a difficult and challenging issue. How do we know whether a character trait is or is not an essential element? What's the alternative to it being an essential element? Nobody likes a smarty pants. Anybody know what the alternative is? I should remember your name. Ashley. It's circumstantial
use of character
evidence. Sure. And why is this, in this case, circumstantial use of character evidence and not an essential element? Ashley, can you answer that?
But the evidence have this position, and so because it's got this position, it goes to like the circumstantial use of characterization. And the example they gave was one week in class where character is an essential element of the case. It's like a material fact of the case is like when it's when we're talking about defamation, and you have to use you have to talk about your character to prove whether or not
they were defamed or not. Yeah, so the language that I think you can take to the bank from this case is it's at the top of page 153. In the strict sense, when it is a material fact that under the substantive law determines the rights and liabilities, it is that the character trait is determinative. So you could say that the self-defense is based upon aggressiveness, but that isn't itself determinative of the rights and liabilities. It is only taken into account in deciding the ultimate issue of whether the defendant acted properly in self-defense. I've thought of another example in addition to the ones that we've looked at, and it is in where there's a defense of entrapment. One of the elements of entrapment is that the person was prone to do the criminal act, that they weren't enticed into doing it. So evidence of specific instances of their having engaged in the same criminal conduct is admissible to refute the claim that they were enticed. So that's another case where the character trait is itself the element of the cause of action or defense. Okay, we're not done yet. The court said that it was inadmissible as character evidence, the appellate court. But nonetheless, what did the court do? Yeah. So, what is habit evidence? What do you think it is? And contrasted with character evidence.
I guess I would say habit is like how someone consistently acts in a specific, like, particular situation.
Very good.
Whereas character is more general.
Yeah, specifically reacts to a very narrowly defined situation. Whereas character is, you were going to say?
More generalized, like their demeanor, or like how they, I'm trying to think of the word, I know I just read it, like their temperament, things that are in all situations that apply, like not narrowly specific to a unique circumstance.
Yeah. Again, we're talking circumstantial evidence. But isn't habit evidence circumstantial evidence as well? And in fact, it sounds like violates the character evidence rule. If the person did this conduct, they're likely to have done it again. But you say the difference is, just repeat what you said, you were right.
The difference is like the specificity of the situation, how they react in that particular situation repeatedly, rather than just in general in all different situations.
Exactly. So, and every time you see a discussion of habit evidence, you'll see this line that appears on page 153. Character and habit are closely akin. So, why was this evidence admissible as habit evidence?
Because he repeatedly had those interactions with the cops, those same cops that were violent.
How do we know that he repeatedly did it? How repeatedly does it have to be?
Like
Yeah, that's a good question. Do you think they introduced evidence of four instances, four witnesses with five instances? Is that enough? I mean, we're talking habit. If we introduce the habit evidence, think about in context what we're doing. Okay? We have eyewitnesses here who claim what happened happened, that the plaintiff was the first aggressor. But the habit evidence is offered to prove what exactly? And therefore, he always reacted that way, and therefore, he was the first aggressor here. So the evidence of habit is offered to prove a specific conduct or something. So most likely, habit evidence is going to be used when there is no evidence of what happened. No direct evidence, no eyewitness. And in fact, at common law, if there was an eyewitness, the proponent couldn't introduce habit evidence. The eyewitness evidence had to prevail or not. So the modern law doesn't require that there be no direct evidence or corroboration even. So what's at stake is the possibility of proving an event without any direct evidence or corroborating evidence, but only habit evidence. That's possible. But there are a series of steps that have to be taken to admit claimed habit evidence as habit evidence. What are those steps? What kind of question or questions are presented by the proponent seeking to introduce habit evidence? Did I stump everybody? You all went away. What kind of question is presented? Is there anything? What does the proponent have to do? Let me rephrase it. What does the proponent have to do in order to get habit evidence in? Luis?
He has to prove a sufficient number of instances in the conduct of the question.
Which is to prove what?
The habit.
To prove the habit evidence? That doesn't help me. I'm not understanding your answer. To show what? What is the evidence? Specific instances of conduct. What is it offered to prove?
In this case, in this specific situation, is the violence.
What is it offered to prove?
Habit.
So in order to get the habit evidence in, there's a foundation that must be laid by some sort of proof that there existed in this person a habit. Okay? What kind of question is whether or not the defendant, the person had a habit? In this case, the plaintiff. What kind of question is it? Lauren? What kind of question is the question presented in this scenario of was the plaintiff possessed of a habit? What kind of question is it? I admonished everybody in the class to always be ready for this series of questions. Whenever I ask, what kind of question is it, what am I looking for? A question of fact. What kind of question of fact is it? You're not done by just answering that. You have to look to find out. Oh.
Preliminary question.
a preliminary question of fact. What kind of preliminary question of fact is it?
Of
conditional relevancy. If the evidence doesn't support a finding by somebody that this habit existed, the evidence is not relevant to prove habit. I mean, it's almost self-answering. Next question. What kind of conditional relevancy question is it? What kinds can there be in the universe of conditional relevancy questions? I stumped you again. What?
I'm very stumpable.
I'm sorry.
I'm very stumpable.
Stumpable. Nevers. No, that's the answer that we're going to arrive at as to whether it's judge or jury, but we still have another question to answer before we get there. What kind of conditional relevancy question is it? What kind of conditional relevancy question is for the jury and the jury alone, or the jury ultimately? What? Pure conditional relevancy. What does that mean? Who said pure? Somebody over here said it, I know. Maureen, did you say it?
Yeah.
Ah, you don't want to own up to it, but it shows your insightful brilliance. What does it mean that it's a pure conditional relevancy question? Maria, you know?
That it's not entangled with some other question that can be answered. That the question is solely based on whether it's relevant or not.
So it's only relevance, not entangled with what other kind of question do you mean?
Like, let's say there could be a question of relevance, but it also entangles a constitutional question.
Or a rule of law or evidence. What is involved here? I don't want to have to bend over, so I'm struggling to get this damn thing.
Help
me.
Help you out there. Nice
seeing you. Alma, thank you so much. I guess I shouldn't sit here. That's the takeaway from this. Where were we? What kind of entangled question is there in this scenario? Does the judge have to serve a function here, or is it all purely up to the jury? And if the judge serves a function, what is that function, first and foremost? Well, that's the ultimate question. And if you say that an admissibility question is for the judge, you can't answer any of this because it's not discerning enough. Ultimately, what we're driving at here is whether the evidence is admissible, but whether it's admissible on what grounds. What's the ultimate result of the finding of that fact of habit or not? Question is, was there a habit or was there no habit? What's the result of that determination? Yeah. What? Who's saying that? No, that's not easy enough. That's not complicated enough. What is determined by the finding that there is a habit or not a habit is the application of a rule of evidence, the habit evidence rule. Jurors don't interpret rules of evidence. So we can determine by that analysis that the question of fact presented is whether or not there is a habit is not a pure conditional relevancy question. Because the answer to that determines whether a rule of evidence applies in interpreting the rule of evidence. Not just that it's a rule of evidence that applies, but the interpretation of the rule of evidence is involved. Therefore, the judge has to decide something with respect to whether or not this habit has been shown. Is that something, the ultimate disposition, or is it that it is enough to go to the jury? Well, if it's a finding that determines the application of the rule of evidence, it's for the judge and the judge alone, and therefore it is an admissibility of evidence question, not a conditional relevancy question for the jury. I see some puzzled faces here. Lewis. Because we know that the determination, the finding of the existence of the fact of habit or no habit is determinative of the application of the habit evidence rule, that factual finding should be made by the judge as an admissibility of evidence determination, even though you might look at it as a conditional relevancy question as well. It is, however, not a pure conditional relevancy question. It's one that is mixed up with the determination of whether the law requiring proof of habit is satisfied. So, what is it that the law requires for the judge to have before him or her with respect to evidence? By what standard of proof must the judge find that there's habit or not? Preponderance. Therefore, how much evidence must be presented to the judge? Well, now we have another problem, because the definition of habit is something that will recur almost reflexively. How do you prove that someone will reflexively act a particular way? Are four witnesses to five instances enough? Doesn't seem like it. But in this case, that wasn't all there was. What else was there, Maria? There were four other witnesses who the prosecution was ready, willing, and able to call to some number of other instances of the same behavior. We don't know how many because the court really didn't identify that. So now we have five instances plus at least four others, probably more. Maybe we can say 9 or 10. Is 9 or 10 enough? And the what?
Like the facts of the case. Doesn't it go by the case by case analysis as to how much is enough?
Yeah. But ordinarily, what should a court require to satisfy the foundation for proof of habit that it's an almost what?
Semi-automatic.
Yeah, what is necessary? What do you think other cases involve? I'll give you a hypothetical. It's actually one of the hypotheticals that we look at. Witness testifies that the bus driver ran into him. The proposition is that he went through a stop sign. The defendant, bus company, wants to introduce evidence that I'm going to change the hypothetical, that the bus driver stopped as a matter of habit. What kind of evidence would satisfy that? How about a witness who takes the stand and says, I've been a passenger on this bus for 6 months, and every time I rode, which was once a day for 6 months, I had this bus driver as my driver. And I observed that he always during that 6 month period stopped at the stop sign. That's the kind of case where you would expect habit to be satisfied. So there's a serious question whether the court was right to find in this case, because we don't know how often the defendant was faced with uniformed police officers and whether on each and every occasion he was observed to have this passionate reaction. Ashley, you had a question? Well, that would have been contrary to claimed habit evidence and probably would have defeated it, I would think. But there probably wasn't anybody, because who would have witnessed that? Okay, so what's the takeaway from this case? It's wrong on every count, in all likelihood. It's wrong as to the application of the character evidence rule in the first instance. Probably okay on the specific instances of conduct exclusion for character purposes, but probably wrong with respect to the establishment of habit. But if habit could be established, then it would be proper. And remember, this is an appellate court decision, so the trial court didn't make a finding of the existence of the habit, which might be subject to deference and not assailable. So that's what happened here. Okay. Anybody have any questions? Alma.
So I'm just trying to grapple with this habit evidence a little bit. It only needs to be determined by a preponderance evidence, but it's not just a habit. It's like a every time thing. Like it's like we were just basically introducing, if one time the parent was pulled over by a cop and he didn't do anything, all of a sudden that ruins the habit of it. So you can't bring it in because obviously it's not every single time.
Pretty much. Okay. Remember, this is a rule that is predicated on the assumption of a substitution for evidence of the event taking place. So in order to prove that it happened, there has to be some reliability. And the foundation of proof of habit is somewhat strict. So you can't expect people to do 100% proof of every single instance of the behavior, but if it's enough.
Because you only need a preponderance of evidence, so you would think that bar sounds super high.
Yeah, but what's the question that is answered by a preponderance? Whether the person would, when faced with these situations, have an automatic response. Now, notice that this rule doesn't just say habit evidence, it says routine practice. So, this rule allows the admission into evidence of events taking place in an entirely different setting. So business organizations can establish events by proof of a routine practice. One of the pristine examples is mailing of business documents. Most businesses have a routine set up. The person who writes a letter puts it in an outbox. The mail guy comes and picks up what's in the outbox, takes it to the mailroom. The mailroom personnel put a stamp on it and put it in the mailing receptacle. So, what would you do to prove that a letter was mailed in those circumstances? Well, the guy who wrote the letter would just testify, I wrote a letter, I put it in the outbox. Is there a practice that your company follows? What do you know happens when you put it in the outbox? And then the testimony is, this is what happens. And it happens all the time. Does it have to be shown that it has never failed? No. So routine practice is another avenue for admission of such evidence. Okay. The excerpt from Park et al. Is a reiteration of the judicial decision in Perrin. But it's somewhat helpful. Character is a generalized description of one's general trait, disposition, or propensity. Habit, more specific, describing one's regular response to a repeated or specific situation. And the point I made just now, routine practice of organizations. And available regardless of eyewitness testimony. That's significant. Generally, habit evidence tends to be semi-automatic. We've talked about that. Frequently failing to stop at a stop sign, for example, would be evidence of a character trait of negligence. Oh, God, I just remembered that yesterday I got a ticket. The second ticket in 2 weeks. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. This cop said I didn't stop at the stop sign. I know I stepped on the brakes. He said, you're going to say you stepped on the brakes. He said, I was here to make sure that you came to a complete stop, and you didn't. So, I got to do something. I said, how likely is it that you're not going to show up? He said, 5%. I won't show up. 95, I will.
You asked him?
I did. So now he's going to be ready for me. But I do have in my hip pocket a secret weapon. My next door neighbor is a very effective criminal defense lawyer. He started out doing traffic tickets when he went into his own practice. And I'm going to recruit him or someone in his office, he's now gotten much bigger than that, to see if he can help me and tell me what to do about both tickets. The one in Beverly Hills was for an illegal U-turn. You laugh. I go to get my hair cut at this upscale salon on Cannon Drive in Beverly Hills. And you can never find a parking space. And it's always on the other side of the street. And I always checked for cops, but I missed him this time. I didn't even ask him anything. So I was going to do traffic school for the U-turn, but I can't do traffic school for both. So I'll probably fight the stop sign and do traffic school for the other. So, frequently failing to stop at stop signs. I always stop at stop signs. That's my defense to the stop sign. Okay. Habit, always failing to stop at a specific intersection, always. Okay, that gets us to the other case with respect to habit and routine practice. The Halloran case. Julia.
Hi.
Hi. You saw me eyeing you. So what was this case about? So plaintiff was who?
He was a mechanic.
An auto mechanic. And what was he doing?
So he was servicing an air conditioning unit, and to accelerate the flow of the refrigerant, he put the can of Freon in a tin of...
What the hell is Freon, anyway?
Well,
Yeah. But how does it work? Who knows? My whole life I've wondered what Freon is. And I haven't Googled it, but probably I will. So why did he sue the manufacturer of the refrigerant? Yeah, the can exploded. And what was the defendant's defense?
Well, they said that he wasn't paying attention to the warning label.
So contributory negligence. Okay. What were the facts of how this accident, quote unquote, happened? Yeah.
So I think he had done three of them, or he had done two of them successfully. On the third one, I think he had to use his process of adding the water to the Freon to get it flowing, and he had a problem of putting it in. And I guess on the fourth one, he noticed that something was going wrong when he added it to the water, and it ended up exploding before he could reach the ground for it.
What did the defendant claim caused the explosion?
The defendant said that the high temperature of it.
The high temperature of what?
Of the water.
How did the water get to a high temperature?
Was it the excessive heating of the can?
How did the can get excessively heated? Immersion coil. What's an immersion coil? Ah! You fell right into my trap. How many of you know what an immersion coil is? Two people? Three people. Oh my God, once again, how could you read this case and not look up what an immersion coil is? So, I'll put you all to shame. That's an immersion coil. It's a modern one. The ones that we had when I was in college were kind of more rudimentary. But this is what it is. It's an electrical device that has a coil that heats up, and you put it in a liquid, and it heats the liquid. When I went to college, everybody had an immersion coil. You couldn't live without it. Heating up coffee, soup, water for tea. What the hell do you think I was doing? What could you use that for otherwise? You're suggesting that there was some dastardly...
No, we're just curious.
Oh, okay. So, I Googled that. It took 10 seconds to find that. Another 15 to download it. Another 10 to transfer it to the right directory. So, okay. So what was the dispute in this case? Yeah, so what did the court hold with respect to the admissibility of this evidence?
So I think the court held that it was allowed to prove that he didn't have a practice of doing it,
So what rule did they apply?
They did basically say that
I guess we left this out. The trial court excluded the evidence. So this case went up on appeal. You know what the Court of Appeals of New York is, Julia? It is. Well, it's what we call the Supreme Court. The Court of Appeals of New York is the highest court. It's the best way of putting it. If you go to New York and you say, I want to go to the Supreme Court, you want to go to a trial court, which is kind of odd. There are appellate courts in between the Supreme Court trial court and the Court of Appeals, the highest court. But they're not called, I don't know, they're the appellate division of the Supreme Court. Very confusing. Okay, so what did the appeals court hold? Right. If it was just evidence of carelessness, that would be what?
If there was evidence of carelessness, they said that it would have been inadmissible.
It would have been inadmissible what?
Intent.
What?
It would have been an inadmissible evidence.
It would be inadmissible character evidence. So, but evidence of repetitive pattern of specific behavior, habit may be introduced if relevant. And what they said here was he had followed a routine of negligently heating thousands of similar cans with an immersion coil without incident. He was very lucky. Now, you said that they didn't cite Rule 406. What do you think that was? Yes, excellent. New York has not, had not, and still hasn't, adopted the federal rules of evidence. They have their own law of evidence. So if you want to take the New York bar, you have to study the law of evidence in New York, not the federal rules. And it is different. Okay, now I want to do some of the hypotheticals to finish out the day. There's two sets of hypotheticals I will address. The first is on page 154, and some of these you've already addressed. And some of them were in quizzes. So, Elias, first one. Defendant is charged with murder arising from a barroom brawl. In its opening statement, the defense states that the evidence will show that the alleged victim, V, was the first attacker and that the defendant acted in self-defense. In each of these cases, is the indicated evidence admissible? First, D offers evidence that V had a bad reputation for violence. Admissible or not?
Admissible.
Why? How did you reach that conclusion? Well, how did you come up with an answer? You just guessed? It's either yes or no. You got a 50% chance. Justin?
He's allowed to offer reputation or pain evidence, just not specific acts. So he's allowed to get himself using, in this case, reputation.
Why is he allowed to offer character evidence?
For A, so he can make reference to what he knows about the defendant or about the
About the victim.
Yeah, and it requires
specific. Not what he knows. He can introduce what? Reputation or opinion.
Yeah.
Okay, the easy answer is it's the mercy rule. Character evidence is permitted to be introduced on behalf of a criminal defendant due to the so-called mercy rule. All right. Defendant offers evidence that the victim previously shot someone in a fit of road rage. Elias, back to you. You thought you were done. Did you think you were done?
No.
Right answer. Exactly. Specific instance of conduct, although the mercy rule would allow him to prove bad character of the victim for aggressiveness, he can't do it by specific instances of conduct. Three, defendant offers evidence that weeks before the incident that caused V's death, V attacked defendant in a fit of road rage. Dante. Boy, that's a good answer. This is more complicated. And maybe is all you can do right now. But do it analytically. First of all, does the mercy rule apply? Evidence of a victim's character in a self-defense case offered by the defendant. This is only the first step. Does the mercy, you know what I mean by this question? What? Well, can the defendant prove, seek to prove the character of the victim? Sure, it applies. The mercy rule applies. Doesn't mean that it's going to come in. That's only the first step. Because under the mercy rule, the defendant can introduce evidence of character of the victim. But is that what this evidence is offered to prove? What is it offered to prove?
It's offered to prove that because he had a reason of self-defense from the past prior to the attack.
How would that justify self-defense? Explain that reasoning to me. Whose motive? The victim's motive? So the victim, having attacked the defendant previously, would be motivated to attack him again? Remember, the question here is, who was the first aggressor? Can anybody think of a line of reasoning that doesn't involve the use of the character of the victim? Aaron.
It shows reasonable fear.
But the defense is first aggressor. How does reasonable fear fit into it? I agree with you. It does show reasonable fear. But the theory is the first aggressor theory. What does that translate into? That the defendant wasn't the first aggressor, but the victim was. How does this evidence support that proposition? I want to say Jeannie. Is that right? What?
Janie.
Janie.
Is it through other acts? So it would be...
Well, you're going to escape into 404B.
Yeah.
Well, that won't work, I'll tell you, but I can't even imagine what you're thinking about. category on 404B would you argue it fits within? We just talked about motive, and I don't think that works.
They just had a fight a week ago.
What?
They just had a fight a week ago. How's that not motive?
Motive for who?
For either party to attack each other.
You've changed the facts. There was a barroom brawl. The defendant claims the victim was the first aggressor, and the contested evidence is that weeks before, the victim attacked the defendant in a fit of road rage.
Right.
So?
So they're having a feud.
So the victim, having attacked him previously, is now going to attack him again.
Sure. Well, hey, let's be real, right? Just because you had one fight doesn't mean we're all done.
But that violates the character evidence rule. Or it violates the specific instances of conduct if character can be shown. Maria?
Does it show that the defendant's fear was real?
And therefore?
Self-defense is applicable?
So the defendant was justified in being the first aggressor. But he didn't claim a defense of reasonable fear. He claimed a defense of first aggressor, meaning the victim was the first aggressor and he was not the first aggressor. Those are the elements. Angelica?
I'm guessing, but would it...
Okay. Delara?
Is he trying to offer evidence of like a pertinent trait of this victim?
Which is what? But this is a specific instance of conduct, so even if that's permissible, which it is, he can't prove it by specific instances of conduct. Only reputation and opinion. Sarah?
It's an essential element of the
No. It's an element, but not it is aggressiveness is not in and of itself provable as an element. It's only provable by circumstantial or other evidence. Adam? It can, I tell you that. You all give up?
No.
No, okay. Allison?
Can it show intent?
Whose intent?
The guy who had road rage and attacked him so that he was the first aggressor because they had the fight before. So you're bringing in the road rage to show that he intended.
Okay, the facts are not that they had a fight before. This is a case that arose out of a barroom brawl. But the evidence is that weeks before, the victim attacked the defendant in a fit of road rage. So I don't see intent working here. That's not the issue. The issue is who acted first. Sean? Nah. So he hatched the desire to get him when he had the road rage, which he carried forward to the barroom brawl. You give up? All right, I'll give Navarre? Yeah. No, it is admissible. It's admissible on a non-character reasoning theory. Ashley?
This just makes me think about the parent case, like, the habit, like, maybe trying to...
No, not habit. That's too far out. Okay. The defendant can support the proposition that he did not attack first by proving his fear of the victim. So in the barroom brawl, he knew, in this scenario, that 3 weeks before the victim had attacked him. Therefore, he feared the victim and would not have acted first as first aggressor. You want me to say it again?
Bella, could you distinguish that from what other people said previously?
Yes. You said that.
Other people said that it was proof of a reasonable fear and therefore proof of self-defense. There's two theories of self-defense that I know about. One is first aggressor, and the other is honest, reasonable fear. Honest, reasonable fear is different from first aggressor. It justifies the defendant's conduct in attacking, if you will, even if he was the first attacker. The theory I was saying to you has nothing to do with reasonable fear as a separate basis for self-defense. It is proof of who was the first aggressor by showing that the defendant, having reasonable fear of the victim, would not have acted first. If he didn't act first, then the victim did, thereby making it proof on the first aggressor theory. I hope you got it, because it's a good one, and it works. And it actually comes up in cases. Okay? Alma?
Yeah, can you clarify that first aggressor and a reasonable fear distinction? I guess I didn't think that in criminal law. There's two different theories. One is that you think you're going to get hurt, so you can attack somebody.
Remember we had a case where the old man died of natural causes?
Yeah.
It's like that. If the person acting has an honest, reasonable fear of a threat to serious bodily harm or death, then that justifies anticipating it and acting beforehand and acting in self-defense. Honest, reasonable fear. The other theory is in the face of a raised knife, where there's no honest, reasonable fear without anything happening, but there's something happening. First aggressor. Okay? James.
So I'm trying to understand what rule this falls under. Is that 4482C, which mentions first aggressor?
It is in between the rules. Because it's not evidence of a character trait. So it isn't governed by the character evidence rule. It isn't a 404B bad act to come within one of the categories. It is relevant non-character evidence to show the basis for the fear of the victim by the defendant. You could say it's 404B within a category that isn't listed, but it's certainly relevant non-character evidence. And for that purpose, it's admissible. That's a good one, isn't it? So I hope that helps you. Well, let's look at number four. Defendant offers evidence that weeks before the fatal incident, he heard that V shot someone in a fit of road rage. So that's the same result. It comes in to show his reasonable fear, which would justify the conclusion that he did not act first and support the conclusion that the victim acted first. And the last one is within that counter exception to the exception in 404A. After the judge admitted evidence about the bad reputation of V for violence, the prosecution offers evidence of the bad reputation of the defendant for violence, even though the defendant has not offered any evidence of his own good character. So the price of admission for triggering the exception in 404A for proof of the victim's character is that it opens the door for the prosecution to introduce bad character evidence of the defendant, even though the defendant has not offered good character evidence. Okay? All right. The other thing we have is after the rape, after the Sex Crimes Act materials, or before them, we have a set of hypotheticals on page 160. Whew, these are long. Okay, the first one is a good one. Matthew, I'll go over it. X, a prison inmate, is charged with aggravated assault upon A, a fellow prisoner. Have you looked at this before?
I have not, actually.
Okay, then I'll go slowly. The prosecution's case is that X and B, another inmate, assaulted A and stabbed him numerous times. X's defense is that his only part in the fray was to break up a fight between A and B. X calls Y, an inmate who did not witness the fight, to testify that he has known X for 1 month and that in his opinion, X is a nonviolent man. Prosecutor makes an inadmissible character evidence objection. What's the result? So clearly, the defendant is seeking to utilize the mercy rule by offering good character evidence on his behalf for a pertinent trait of being nonviolent. Has he done so properly? And therefore, is the evidence admissible? Or is the prosecutor's objection well-founded and should be sustained? Do you have an opinion, Matthew? What? If he what? Is he talking about specific instances? He's offering an opinion, which is... Okay, is there any grounds for the prosecutor to win? Anybody think so? Allison? That's not the question. The question is it admissible?
Yeah, it is admissible, but you said that...
No, it's not admissible for reasons that you haven't even begun to address. Bianca, you have an opinion? You are laughing heartily. You should be able to reason it out with what you know, even though you haven't addressed it yet.
I would believe that it is admissible because it is his opinion. It's not his giving his opinion about what you think. Like,
what's necessary for an opinion to be admissible?
He has to establish that.
You're holding your hand over your mouth.
He has to establish that he knew him or knew of his...
No, knew of is reputation.
Okay, so
knew him is opinion. Knew him how?
For a certain, substantial amount of time.
Is 1 month a substantial amount of time?
Not.
What?
Maybe it's not.
Maybe it's not? The only argument that could prevail that it is enough is that in prison you get to know someone very quickly. But on the face of it, it's not a sufficient foundation for opinion. Which is an easy answer, but you probably weren't thinking about it. Okay? What? Yeah, it would have been admissible opinion evidence if the character witness was qualified. 404 A to A or B, I don't know which. Oh, you're playing me. Okay. 404A2. Hey. All right, number two. Oh, we've already done this one. This is the escape one. Except in this instance, there's evidence of a number of bad acts, number of criminal acts. But it's offered not to prove character, it's offered to prove motive. When a police officer stops a fleeing felon, which is what this is, and the fleeing felon shoots him, the proof of the felonies from which he's fleeing would be admissible under 404B to prove motive. Okay, number three is the scam of the celebration of the birth of a child, sought to be admitted under MO. So the given acceptance of the given answer to this is that it does satisfy modus operandi, that it's unique enough. But I think that it's questionable. It may be a scam that seems unique, but isn't unique enough. But the best answer would be that it satisfies MO. Number four, this is one that was on the quiz as well. The stomach stomper. Offered as modus operandi, it can't make it because it's not unique enough. It's just that simple. And then, of course, five is the arguable habit evidence that doesn't make it as habit evidence. Oh, wait, it does, because in the six-month period, the habit witness says the subject failed to come to a stop at the intersection. So it's specific enough, and it's repeated enough to satisfy all aspects of the habit rule. That's it for today. A hearty round of applause. Standing ovation.